Cemetery News Now.
This is Telemetry News Now, a bi-weekly tech news podcast hosted by Leon Addato, Justin Ryburn, and yours truly, Philip Gervasi. Here we are ending the summer season, inching ever so closely to fall 2024. Here in the Northeast where I live, we have already abandoned all vestiges of summertime fun and pools and floaty toys and have embraced with both arms cozy sweaters and pumpkin spice lattes. Pumpkin spice everything, if I'm going to be honest. So, without further ado, let's get into the headlines for this week. So, gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I'd like to start off with a big one in the service provider space, something near and dear to our heart here at Kentik, Verizon to acquire Frontier Communications. So, according to Reuters, Verizon said on, two Thursdays ago, it would buy Frontier Communications in an all-cash deal valued at $20 billion, with a B, as the U.S. wireless carrier looks to boost its fiber network. Shares of Frontier Communications fell 2 weeks ago for about 9% in pre-market trading, and Verizon climbed about 1%. So the acquisition is expected to close in about 18 months, with pundits and talking heads getting into the fray right now, talking about how this is going to help Verizon better compete against AT&T and how it's going to span multiple states beyond the Midwest, Texas, California, and others. So, gentlemen, let's start with that one. And I know, especially for me in the Northeast region, Frontier is sort of a dirty word.
So it's nice to see providers expanding their footprint, expanding their capability. Although the thing that I keep coming back to, because I surf the local ISP speed rates and dollar rates often. I have no problem switching out from one to another. And the reality is that for folks who are in the Verizon service area or the Frontier service area, okay, fine. But it's city by city. Like if you are in an AT&T city, you are not getting Verizon and vice versa. So it's nice, but most cities are already locked in barring some sort of, you know, major shakeup. So like, okay, good for them, I guess. Or if you have stock.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the map that we can link in the article in the show notes, there's not a lot of overlap. You know, they have blue for the Frontier areas and red for the Verizon areas. Frontier is going to bring 2.2 million subscribers to the table. Verizon's Fios has about 7.4 million today. But to Leon's point, they're in different cities. They're in different parts of the country. So it really is, the new Verizon going forward. They're basically picking up additional markets and additional customers where they really don't have any overlap. So there's not really a loss of competitors in the market here, which I think is, you know, part of the reason this is likely going to make it through the regulators.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a statement here from the CEO of Verizon, Hans Vestberg. The acquisition of Frontier is a strategic fit. It will build on Verizon's two decades of leadership, and it is an opportunity to become more competitive in more markets throughout the United States. So yeah, I hear what you're saying, Leon. So not necessarily competing with AT&T toe-to-toe in a particular city or metro area, but certainly expanding its footprint on a large geographic scale across the entire country altogether. So moving on, big news in the political, global political and AI space, if there is such a thing, I guess there is now. The US, UK and EU sign on to the Council of Europe's high-level AI safety treaty. We have some information here from Capacity Media, TechCrunch, Reuters, and a variety of blog posts out there. So ultimately, we are looking at the first legally binding international AI treaty, whatever that is, signed last week by several countries, not all of them in the committee consortium just yet, but several that negotiated it, including European Union members, the United States, Britain, Andorra, Iceland, so within Europe and then and outside of Europe. Ultimately, this was spawned by an organization called the AI Convention, been in the works for years, and then adopted just this past May after discussion among those 57 countries. Ultimately, addressing the risks of AI, the risks that AI may pose, and then promoting responsible innovation. I don't know about you, gentlemen, but this could be a series of podcasts to unpack unto itself.
A series of ongoing podcasts.
Yeah, good point. Right.
Yeah. I'm going to just simply inject that aside from any other news source, Her Royal Highness Taylor Swift also weighed in on this week as part of her endorsement for one particular political party, and said that she had deep concerns about AI, deep fakes and things like that, which is why she took a public stance. And that's really all I need to know.
And that's all you need to know.
That's honestly, okay. So I really think that this is a long time coming. It's long overdue already. I don't think that throwing more government at something is going to make it better, but I am also scarred, old, and skeptical enough to know from experience that letting vendors run amok really, honestly, and no hyperbole here, gets people hurt. So yes, I'm all for this.
This may be one of the few things AI related I agree with Leon on. I think that, you know, this is one of the main problems or one of the main concerns people have with using AI, right? Is how do we use it safely? How do we use it appropriately? How do we keep the deep fakes from, you know, making their way out onto the internet? So, I agree. I'm not usually a big proponent of having government agencies who may not fully understand the technology bring regulation to the table, because they tend to not necessarily do it right because they don't fully understand the technology that they're building policy around. But I think something needs to be, something's better than nothing, right? And so getting opinions, getting people together to talk about how do we implement AI safely, how do we put some guardrails around it earlier in the process, because we're still early days on AI, let's be honest, I think is the right move here. I think, you know, if we had gotten some policy around the internet earlier on, maybe some of the things we still deal with today wouldn't be nearly as big a problems. I think we'll find out.
I mean, I get it. I agree with both of you about the idea of keeping people safe, keeping information safe and accurate and free, and also open. You know, the entire underlying premise that the access to information and accurate information is very important to a thriving, healthy society and culture. All of that I get, but when you use the word guardrails and the idea of government policy and governments in general just kind of overseeing all of this for us on our behalf does make me a little bit concerned. I mean, who gets to determine what those guardrails are? What does guardrail even mean? What does that mean when we're talking about algorithms and you know, built into generative AI models that develop text and video and audio? So yeah, sure, I want to make sure that that stuff is, they're not deep fakes that adversely affect me or my family or my community. But at the same time, there is a significant amount of complexity in that, because we are talking about weights and biases, and think about how transformer models work. I mean, this is very technical in nature, and now we're going to have a government kind of put guardrails on how all of that's going to operate and therefore what kind of content it generates. So as an aside, actually not really as an aside, but very much related, the Council of Europe Secretary General, Maria Pejcinović Burić, said, "We must ensure," quote, "we must ensure that the rise of AI upholds our standards rather than undermining them. The Framework Convention is designed to ensure just that. It is a strong and balanced text," referring to the treaty, "the result of the open and inclusive approach by which it was drafted and which ensured that it benefits from multiple and expert perspectives. The Framework Convention is an open treaty with a potentially global reach. I hope that these will be the first of many signatures and that they will be followed quickly by ratifications so that the treaty can enter into force as soon as possible." There's a lot of heavy words there. Expert perspectives. And then, of course, at the end, you know, enter into force. Does that mean that there's some sort of accountability system? Multinational, international accountability system? So if my model doesn't produce the things that these folks say it should produce, I am going to have to pay some sort of consequence. So yeah, you know, I'm with you guys, but I am also, somewhat, maybe in a healthy way, I don't know, skeptical.
Well, and I think that's been one of the challenges with policy on the internet generally, right? Is how do you enforce it across internet boundary, international boundaries, right? I mean, the internet is a global thing. AI is going to be a global thing. So you've got to get these multinational US, EU, UK organizations to come together and sign almost like a treaty to say, yes, we're going to agree to work together and to put some meat behind some penalties if people are in violation of some of these things. I mean, it's worked for GDPR is the only good analogy I have, I think, for this.
I was just going to bring that up. I was going to say that the EU did not do a bad job on GDPR. It's not perfect. Nothing is. But they didn't do a bad job. And I think that what we're seeing, if we take a step back from this AI issue, is that international organizations are learning how to craft, you want to say regulations, you want to say guidelines, whatever word you want to use for it, they are learning how to do this with regard to the internet. And AI is a critical need. And so they're gonna do it. And hopefully they'll have a good first shot. It's not going to be perfect, but hopefully it's iterative. I also like the quote I read from it's UK's Lord Chancellor, and I'm an American, so I don't know what that means in terms of rank, but the UK's Lord Chancellor, Shabana Mahmood. And he basically said that we must shape AI. We cannot let AI shape us. And I think that as a guiding principle is not a bad thing as a core value, whether or not, again, the first iteration or the second iteration ends up being perfect. I think it's still very necessary and worth trying. And I just realized I did a quick Google search. I misgendered Ms. Mahmood. Shabana is not a he, so I apologize. That, again, just exposing my extreme Americanisms and not knowing public figures in the UK.
I mean, you make an interesting point. Your perspective is that this is an iterative process, and that makes a lot of sense. I mean, we are trying to figure this out as we go, for sure. And I don't really think that it's a one or the other scenario. Like, is AI going to control us, or are we going to control it? Just like, does art inform our humanity, or does humanity inform art, and that entire paradigm? So I do think that there is some more complexity and nuance to it. And I think we should be paying attention to the entire digital rights thing, which is something that pops up on this. Well, not this, but the main podcast, Telemetry Now, quite a bit. I just read some literature from the Center for AI and Digital Privacy that's looking at this stuff. And it looks at this treaty very much in the context of digital rights and human rights and what role AI will play in all of that. So really interesting that it's both from a technical perspective, how we can keep things safe, but also how AI will play a role in the advancement of digital and, for some, human rights.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be very important for any of these regulators to stay up on the latest developments, like what the next article talks about, right? As far as like pre-trained AI workflows. Like, there's a lot of technology that's changing and evolving, and if they're going to build policy around AI, they're going to have to keep up to date on the latest trends and what's coming up.
Yeah, it's an interesting point that you make, Justin, because I was looking at Ollama the other day and installing that on my laptop. And then, like, by the time it was done, because it's like 20 gigabytes, right? By the time I'm done installing it, I look back at like their homepage and I'm like, oh, a new update? Like, in the time I was installing the thing and downloading it, I mean, I got a 300 meg pipe at home, which is not tiny, but, you know, it took a while, right? It literally, there was an update. So, like, how are regulators going to keep up pace with the pace of technological advancement in this area right now? So moving on, we have some really interesting news from the realm of fiber optics and submarine telecom cables, or what we assume eventually will lead to submarine telecom cables. Ciena and Aurelion achieve 1.6 terabits per second optical transmission milestone. And for anyone in networking, we all love more bandwidth. Ciena's Wavelength 6 Extreme WL6E, better known as, is the optical networking technology that enabled this new speed in carrier data network transport specifically. So we're looking at the world's first 1.6 terabits per second wavelength data transmission in a live network trial. This is not something that's on paper. This is a trial that took place on Aurelion's network, specifically between two points of presence, cable landing stations, one in Ashburn, Virginia, an Equinix facility, I believe, and then Virginia Beach cable landing station. So pretty cool. I can only imagine the improvements that we're going to be able to see once this trickles out into industry.
Yeah, I think this one's going to be really fascinating. I mean, presumably, since they're connecting to a cable landing station, the next step is to upgrade the capacity on the undersea cable that lands at that undersea cable landing station, right? So that you know, if you think about it, if they're doing 800 meg per wavelength on that fiber optic today, they can upgrade to 1.6. That doubles the speed without them having to invest in any infrastructure for that undersea cable, which we know from, you know, having other guests on the main show that that's an expensive proposition, very time consuming. So I think there's going to be, you know, really interesting to see where this goes. I also can't wait to see this inside of a data center. Right. I know all three of us have done a lot of researching on networking and AI environments and the interconnection of GPUs inside of a data center. And this is one of the big things that people have been waiting on in those environments, is to be able to upgrade each individual link from 800 meg to 1.6 terabits. So I think it'll be interesting to see as it starts to come to fruition on Ethernet switches inside of a data center, to see these kind of speeds will be really exciting.
Yeah, the things you've already talked about it, but the thing that jumped out at me when I was reading the article was it was a live field trial using existing network, and they're willing to say out loud that they're looking for deployment Q4 of this year, or Q1 of 2025. Like those are bold statements, and it's very heartening. And just for context, for those people who don't know, my youngest son is an engineering student. So I am flooded on a near constant basis from him with all the articles that he is excited about, from cold fusion and high capacity batteries to transporting people through pneumatic tubes. And I wish I was making that up, but yes, that was a thing that we discussed the other night, is putting people in a pneumatic tube and could we transport them that way, because he's an engineering student and reality is often optional. So my point is that I see a lot of stuff that's just purely theoretical, that's a paper or an idea or whatever. So it was really nice to see this very ambitious, very significant scientific jump that was real.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. What you said reminded me of Futurama. Remember how they kind of get around the city?
I was thinking of Star Trek, Beam Me Up, Scotty.
Beam Me Up is a whole other thing, but he really put people into a pneumatic tube and then push them in a way that will not kill them. So
yeah. Yeah. Some sort of pod or something. So yeah, this is really great news though, for, I mean, just the backbone of the internet. And ultimately what we're talking about is carrier networks and backhaul networks. And so this is just going to enable those huge data transfers for tier one service providers, for, the cloud providers that are moving traffic over submarine cables. Because generally speaking, we're not sending traffic over submarine cables. That's going to go to some local POP. And, and the technology that it's enabling this, the transmitters, receivers, and all that stuff, that's in-house development at Ciena. And so that's not out there in industry yet. So there is going to be a delay here. But in the near term, you know, I do think that we're going to see this deployed more or less in maybe those cable spurs that are much shorter in length. And then in short haul cables that are lighting up very high demand areas. Remember that these are very, very expensive if you're deploying new submarine cables altogether, with the ecological and topographical surveys and all the lawyers involved. And then, of course, the cost of the cable and the deployment, all of that. And the fact that cables are often deployed in multiples for fault tolerance and redundancy. So I do think we're going to see it first in those short haul and cable spurs and that kind of thing, high demand areas. And then as far as trickling out to the data center, you know, I don't know. That's certainly, we're starting to see those very, very high bandwidth links in the data center already, with how we're networking for AI workloads.
Right. The other point that isn't made in any of the articles, but I think is worth mentioning every time there's this speed jump, is we always think about, like, what if I had, you know, what if I replaced every piece of cable with this faster thing? But also it allows you to reduce your cable density. You know, that now I can get the same amount of data moving on a smaller number of wires, you know, and that has a real impact on climate and ecology, because if you can reduce cable density, it reduces heat. I mean, that is a very real thing. When people talk about the way that you stack cables together, because eventually you have this massive, you know, pipeline of cable that is generating so much heat, it begins to melt the cables themselves. So reducing cable density reduces heat, which reduces your need for cooling, which reduces the overall energy consumption. And that is not something to to overlook. It's obviously not the thing that Phil, you and I are thinking of. We're thinking of, I want this in my house.
Yeah, right.
But, and I think there's a lot of folks, and Justin, to your point, like, oh, how would this impact AI? How do I just move more data faster? But there's also the reduction aspect that I think is worth keeping an eye on as this article moves, as this technology moves forward and as we continue to track it in the news.
Well, that's also one of the challenges that they have in AI data centers, right, is power and cooling density, you know, when you get into those dense environments too. So making things more efficient, being able to get twice as much bandwidth on the same, you know, link, whether we're talking fiber or copper, is part of the, you know, what's exciting to this, to me.
Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. I hear you. And that is something that is a concern in the data center for sure. Power and cooling, especially for bespoke data centers designed and built for AI workloads. But I think it is important to remember that this is not like a blip in humanity's existence, that we have this thing called the internet that's going to die out next year. Maybe it will one day, but the exponential growth in the data being transferred, especially in recent days, is such that I don't think that we're going to deploy 1.6 terabits per second links. First of all, we don't deploy things like that in the submarine cable world as single cables. They are deployed in multiple for redundancy. So there's that. And the fact that we're going to consume it, we're going to consume it very quickly. Think about how generative AI models and general AI models are now becoming more ubiquitous in that data is being ingested back in from the world into these models. So they're not just reaching out and looking at the internet, but there's this kind of reverse CDN thing going, where instead of like a streaming provider sending out to all the individual POPs and then to individual homes in order to reduce latency and improve performance and doing that in a distributed fashion, imagine that in the reverse, of all the telemetry from all the devices in your house and all this stuff, all the data going back then feeding into, you know, through your local community's CO down the street into local POP across secondary providers, then primary tier one providers back to the web scale AI companies. This is a tremendous amount of bandwidth. I foresee this only increasing more and more. 1.6 terabits per second is awesome, and I do foresee that becoming much, much more in the near future. That is not going to slow down. I think it's just going to be a major focus of research for folks that only need more bandwidth. So, all right. So let's move on. This is near and dear to our heart here at Kentik. White House brands BGP routing a national security concern as it unveils a reform roadmap. So it's not that we are glad that BGP is a national security concern, but we are very happy to say that the White House actually cited and referred to our very own Doug Madory's article and research and analysis in as an expert opinion in their own development of policy, shall we say, moving forward with securing the internet itself. So according to a White House fact sheet, BGP's original design properties do not adequately address the threat to and resilience toward requirements of today's internet ecosystem. Therefore, the potential for widespread disruption of internet infrastructure, whether carried out accidentally or maliciously, is a national security concern. It's interesting stuff. You know, I've seen so many articles from Doug specifically, and then from others within our company and others that we work with about this very thing, that BGP is built largely on trust, and that can open up attack vectors, malicious actors that want to do bad things, but also just misconfigurations. And so having a system in place to secure that, I think the White House finally sees that as an important thing, considering the internet is not just a thing for email and cat pictures or cat videos now because we have high bandwidth, but it is literally like a mechanism, a substrate for people to access information, you know, i.e. democracy, and for, you know, the sharing of information, the advancement of technology, culture, all of these things. So it's really interesting stuff that we're seeing that finally from the highest levels of government.
Well, and in 2024, we have a lot of our critical infrastructure connected to the internet, right? Power,
yeah, that grid, too.
You know, all kinds too. Of stuff. So there's, you know, there is a very real national security angle to the internet in general, right? And having it be resilient, like you said, is, you know, BGP is not working. The internet's not working effectively, right? I mean, that's just the way it works, right?
Right. I like the fact that BGP being a national security concern matches my BGP is a will I pass the CCNA concern of mine personally. So like I'm glad that national interests match up with my personal interests for once. One thing that jumped out at me in this article that we were looking at was they said that BGP is, quote, infamously prone to configuration errors, unquote, which seems like, once again, a Leon can't pass the CCNA problem, not a protocol error per se. I mean, like, you know, things are complicated sometimes. Sometimes they're difficult. Sometimes it requires somebody with some skill to do.
Yeah.
That by itself didn't seem like, oh, we need to address this or have a, this goes back to what we were saying earlier about throwing more government at something doesn't always make it better. Like, I don't know that this is a reason to get government involved. However, the other thing that jumped out at me was this idea of hurry up and implement. The full quote is, ONCD wants federal agencies and network operators to hurry up and implement. And they go on, but what they're talking about is RPKI, implement this thing. And what's interesting to me is that in the blog article that was cited, which came from May of 2024, that blog article was specifically because a majority of IPv4 routes were covered by RPKI already. Now, I have to admit, a majority means 50.08%. It was just barely over the line of majority. But here in 2024, half of the routes are already protected by RPKI. So this hurry up, like, we're halfway there. When did you want it? And as far back as 2 years ago, Doug's analysis showed that, yes, you're right, only a third of the BGP routes had ROA, but the traffic, which is really what we care about, right? Like, we don't really care about how many routes, we care about the traffic. At that point, 2 years ago, 56.5% of the traffic had ROA.
Uh-huh.
So we're not that far behind. I mean, like, yes, important to do, but this is not like, you know, hair on fire, oh my gosh, grab the cat, we got to get out of the house kind of emergencies.
Yeah. Play devil's advocate, though. Like, you know, it's great if 56% of the traffic is covered, but if the traffic you care about, your, you know, particular connectivity to, you know, your bank to do your online banking or whatever is down, it's not much consolation that, you know, 56% of it is covered, right? And I think that's kind of the point here is, like, anything less than, you know, 99.9%, you know, five nines, whatever, is still a problem. And I think that's what the White House is trying to get at here is to encourage everybody to adopt ROA, to sign your prefixes, to do RPKI strict test, checking before injecting those routes into your routing table. I mean, Doug and others' research has proved that it's safe. I mean, you know, we can safely do this. ROA does work, and everybody should start doing it.
And if the point was we should have been there by now, like, come on, people. And it's just going to require a governmental kick in the butt. OK, cool. I can take it.
And it isn't just the implementation of route origin authorizations, ROAs, but also the validation. That's They're different and they're very important. They're different entities. If you're not familiar with RPKI, Resource Public Key Infrastructure, very important in securing BGP updates and basically validating, ultimately authorizing, and then validating, is this prefix something that I should be installing to my route table? Is this something I can trust? And there's a whole series of steps that happens for that to happen, for that to occur. And ultimately, that along with other mechanisms, that's the one that's called out here by the White House, but there are also other mechanisms, as you all know, in the onion of security that can help to mitigate the adverse effects of malicious actors and misconfigurations with BGP and anything else on the internet for that matter. But it is important that there are multiple components here. There is a step, multiple steps of adoption. I think I disagree with you on one point, though, Justin. I don't think we need 99.99959's adoption for it to be really, really effective. Because if the biggest, like the tier one service providers and like the biggest CDNs and cloud providers, if they're all, they have all adopted RPKI, which, by the way, is kind of the impetus here. Mm-hmm. The White House is, through whatever organizations here that they're working with, they're looking at getting the larger ISPs to adopt RPKI, which most of them already kind of do. And when you do that, what happens is, you know, so I want to set up a peering relationship with AWS or with Cogent or whoever, or, you know, a smaller ISP with a larger ISP. Ultimately, at some point upstream, you sort of need to be, you need to be using RPKI if you want to be on the internet. So no, that's not like a blanket statement where therefore all you have to, and you can't get on. But at some point, if you are interoperating with one of those larger providers, whether it be a content delivery network, you know, the cloud provider, a large ISP, something like that, we're seeing it now. You know, I know just in having talked to Doug about this a few times, it's amazing how many times Doug's name has come up in this particular segment. He's seeing like large organizations, like a big healthcare system. When I say a healthcare system, picture like a hospital system with like 15 hospitals and 50,000 employees. You know, if you have a presence on the internet, it's something you should consider. So certainly the trickle down to enterprise, large enterprise, and then whatever you want to define medium size enterprise as is certainly starting to happen. But I don't think that we need to have five nines of adoption for it to be a real significant improvement. I'm sure you agree with that though, Justin. I mean,
I don't know that you need five nines of all the ASNs on the internet to exactly. Adopt that's RPKI what I was referring strict to. In order to be able to get there. To your point though, if we had 100% of the tier one carriers that were doing strict checking, we'd get to 99% of the prefixes or 99% of the traffic.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
One other thing before we move off from this topic that I think you hit on, but is worth double clicking on is this whole conversation has been about route authorization, right? ROA, route origin authorization.
Yeah, we have the ROA, but remember for the audience's sake that there is also the ROV, the route origin validation. And that is, I mean, just as if not more important, because the authorization is what we use to prove to the world that we own these prefixes and that we should and are able to advertise them. And the validation is the process of actually validating that that's true when we see BGP update messages. So it is overall part of the entire RPKI, though. So keep in mind that that's really what we're talking about is RPKI, not necessarily one of the components.
That is only going to fix who is originating the route in the table. It is not going to do anything to help with the path. So if there's a hijack halfway in the path, it's not going to fix that. So lest we make it sound like this is PFM and is going to fix all of our BGP problems on the internet, there are still additional problems that as an industry, we're going to have to continue to work on even once ROA is completely rolled out.
Yeah, great point. And so for those of you that are interested in learning more about RPKI, we have several podcasts and about 875 blogs written about RPKI and various aspects regarding RPKI as well. Because as Justin said, it is not like an encryption method. It's a method for securing BGP update messages, not securing, but like, do I trust this sender of this particular prefix and can I install it into my routing table? So moving on to the cloud world, Oracle expands multi-cloud capabilities with AWS, Google, and Microsoft Azure. So Oracle is collaborating with Amazon, Google, and Microsoft to help their customers accelerate their application migrations and modernizations. So OCI, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, deployed in AWS, Google, and Microsoft data centers, respectively. And that satisfies, like, the idea here is that it satisfies this increasing demand for Oracle database services running on OCI, so that Oracle will work with AWS, Google, and Azure, and then, you know, expand their availability.
Yeah, you know, it's Oracle's strategy around OCI has always been a little interesting to me, and it kind of comes back, in summary that I think is best on this is like, Oracle is the best for running Oracle databases, right? And it's really actually not that much different than when Azure first launched, and it was basically Microsoft is the best place to run your Windows and your Active Directory and, you know, OS 365 Exchange it on, right? So if you think about it from that perspective, from Oracle's perspective, if I'm going to migrate a database from my on-prem data center to Oracle, how do I get connectivity to that? And they have the ability to run compute, obviously, in OCI, but they've taken a strategy of let's get good connectivity to the other three major public cloud providers so that if you're running your application front end and another cloud provider, and the database calls are coming back to Oracle database, the latency is low, the performance is high between those two public cloud environments. And that's what this announcement seems to support, is they're continuing along that strategy.
Yeah, I'm working really, really hard, because I am not Corey Quinn. I'm working really hard not to like bash on certain public individuals who may or may not ask for it on a regular basis because of ego. I'm trying really hard. You can tell I'm almost not doing it, but there has been a push for a really long time from every cloud provider to make their cloud the one true cloud, the one and only true cloud, the one cloud to bring them all in the darkness bind them. And it's nice to see that Oracle is no longer pushing that. At the same time, I think the very real concern is what Oracle is enabling is you to move more data east-west, which is the stuff you pay for. So Now they've made that, I took a look, and they've made that egress ingress cheap, not free, but relatively cheap, certainly cheaper than other cloud providers. Again, I'm not naming names, who refuse to bend on the ingress egress cost. So I guess my one thing would be a caution to everyone reading this article or considering implementing it, is that you still need to be incredibly aware of the data that you're sending out from a particular cloud and bringing in from a particular cloud. If you are doing a select star from and bringing that data in, you are going to, that may be a resume generating event for you a month from now when you have to pay your cloud bill. So just be careful is the one thing I would say. But at the same time, it's nice to see that some things can win out over ego, and one of those things appears to be shareholder value.
Yep. Right. All right. Well, wrapping it up, I'd like to finish out today's episode by going through some upcoming events in the next few weeks or so that are important to the three of us. So starting off just in a couple weeks, on September 26th, is the Kansas City Networking User Group event hosted or put on by the USNUA parent organization. That's in Overland Park. I'll be actually there myself speaking. And then we have SRE Day in London on September 19 and 20, where we'll have our own Leon speaking. His presentation, this I would say it's an infamous presentation called Alerts Don't Suck.
Alerts Don't Suck. Your alerts suck.
Exactly. Thank you for the clarification.
Yep.
I'm starting to see some new events coming out of the Tech Field Day group. So AI Data Infrastructure Field Day 1, October 2nd and 3rd out in Silicon Valley. I say out and because I'm on the East Coast. I'm just going to read off the description because this is a new event. Tech Field Day is hosting a AI Field Day 5 in September and our first ever AI Data Infrastructure Field Day in October. What's the difference? AI Field Day is focused on building and running AI applications in the enterprise, including training and inferencing hardware and software. AI data infrastructure supports the AI pipeline with storage and data management technology. So interesting stuff. Check them out at techfieldday.com/event/AID. Just go to techfieldday.com and look for AI. Yeah, and look for AI to Field Day 1.
That one's really interesting to me, Phil, because if folks haven't checked out one of the Tech Field Day events, they do a really nice job of getting delegates to kind of keep the marketing BS to a minimum in these things, which is, yes, we all know there's been plenty of AI marketing BS over the last few years. So I'm really excited to see Tech Field Day, separate the signal from the noise when it comes to what's real and what's marketecture around AI. So I'm kind of interested to check that one out myself.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking forward to the live stream. And next, of course, we have probably the most important event of the season, perhaps of our lifetime, is the Upstate New York Networking User Group in Saratoga Springs on October 3rd.
Who's hosting that? Who's running that event, Phil?
Oh, that would be yours truly. That is, I live in the capital region of New York, and Saratoga Springs is about half an hour from me. And right in downtown Saratoga off Broadway, we have an awesome venue. And I'm actually not just hosting it. I am speaking at this one because there was a special request for one of the presentations that I gave when I'm out on the road. So I'll be doing that. But that is on October 3rd. If you happen to be in the Capital Region area of New York or the Northeast in general, and you want to drive over. Last but not least, we do have AutoCon 2, an event sponsored, put on by the Network Automation Forum, November 18 through 22 in Denver, Colorado. That's more than a month out, a little bit more than a few weeks that I said, but I wanted to mention it here because workshops are filling up very fast. Early bird conference pricing ends in a couple weeks as well. So visit the Network Automation Forum website, register before all of that is sold out. So thanks so much for listening to the news today.
I'm Leon Adato.
I'm Justin Rabern.
And I'm Phil Gervasi.